Good afternoon, everyone. What a pleasure it is to see Julie Carrick Dalton again, although we still haven't met in the flesh, which is a bummer. So I was really fond of her first book, which we might talk about. I thought it was very exciting. And her new book here, The Last Beekeeper, she's kindly, I think we sent you copies to sign, did we not? Maybe they've actually.
Yeah. I think they should probably be there by now. Yeah.
Excellent. Right. But Julie is in some exotic spot at the moment. Where are you?
I'm in the Dominican Republic. I live in Boston, but my husband and I are celebrating 30 years. So we decided to go somewhere fun. So this is my lovely backdrop of the ocean.
Well, I didn't think it was Boston. Right. Well, anyway, but what a good place to talk about. I guess the sort of publishing term for this is an eco-thriller. So obviously bees. Lives and potential demise or even actual demise in this book are really important. But Julie, let's go back for a moment and talk about Waiting for the Night Song, because I really loved that book. And that was the first time I had read you.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. So I was so excited to do an event with you, and it was during high pandemic, and you were gracious enough to host me. So Waiting for the Night Song was my debut novel, and it was about an entomologist who was trying to convince people that an invasive beetle had moved into New Hampshire and was setting the stage for a forest fire. And there's, you know, maybe a body buried somewhere in the woods and some, you know, old secrets resurfacing. But in the backdrop of it, it was all about the rising temperatures in New Hampshire and how it changed a community over decades of slow burning rise in temperature. I have been farming a piece of land in New Hampshire for about 15 years. And that's where that story came from, because my growing season actually had been extended by 22 days because of slow rising temperatures. So yeah, those eco thriller ideas seem to be the things that capture my imagination.
I was going to ask you, you know, whether do you have personal? I mean, you say you're farming, but you know, what do you have, a biology background or anything, or have you just kind of researched all the scientific aspects of the books?
Well, I actually was a biochemistry major when I started out in college, but then I discovered journalism and it just completely, my mind exploded. I'm like, oh, this is what I'm going to do. So I was a journalist for a long time. So I put the biochem aside, but I've always been really interested in science. And I've been really drawn, especially to soil science, to studying insects and forestry, and not in a formal way. But what happened was we have a family place in New Hampshire that was bordered by this huge stretch of gorgeous, pristine woods. And it went on the market to be timbered and developed. And we have bear and moose and deer that literally walk into my yard from this forest. It's a gorgeous tract of land. It has this brook that runs through it. And so I had this panic, and I partnered up with a friend who needed a barn for her horses, and I bought this tract of land to stop the timbering. And we built a barn together for her horses, and I started farming it. I didn't know what the heck I was doing. I have absolutely no background in farming and no right to be farming. I didn't know what I was doing. I made a lot of mistakes, but I went back to Tufts University and got a certificate in sustainable agriculture. And over 15 years, I learned a lot. I sold my farm about a year ago, only because it was the right time for me. The land is safe. It's in the hands of my business partner. I sold it to her. And I feel like I did what I came to do, but working that land brought me really close to nature in a way I hadn't been since I was a kid. And it made me really kind of witness these things that are happening quietly. You know, we think about climate change as, you know, hurricanes and big forest fires and, you know, rising tidal waters. But there's also a lot of slow elements. And that's what I tend to write about in my books, are the quiet, slow burning elements of climate change that we're already seeing all over the world.
Well, we are. We're actually in the middle, you know, of water crisis here in the Southwest. And it's becoming a major issue in Arizona, even in our homeowner association. We have 16 homes here in this little group that we live in. And one of them, we call him the neighborhood Nazi, really doesn't like Southwest landscaping. He wants everybody to keep grass, and has been rewriting the homeowner rules to increase the amount of grass that all of us are supposed to maintain. And, you know, fortunately, I'm not alone in being outraged. I mean, we're actually looking at water rationing and so forth. So we finally, my husband and I, in order not to have a complete war, worked it out to put artificial turf, tiger turf, which looks very nice, in the front, and all the rest of it is desert landscaping. And, you know, it's important that we have, you know, plants that attract the local insects. We have hummingbirds in our backyard that, you know, we feed them, but also there's plenty for them back there. And, you know, I think even not people farming, but people living, you know, in their own homes with their own gardens, large or small, need to be thinking seriously about what to plant. I think grass is kind of on its way out.
Yeah. I have a really nice pollinator garden. We built this tiny little writer cabin for me as an office. It's out of like salvage wood from an old barn, and I planted a pollinator garden, and I was really shocked about the increase in, you know, different types of bees and butterflies that I was seeing in my yard just in the very first year I planted it. It was pretty shocking to me. And they're all, you know, local pollinators, or they're all plants that are attract local pollinators or native species. So there's a lot of little things, I mean, that we can do, you know, just like you're doing, you know, planting the right kind of things and just being thoughtful about it. But yeah, it's a lot. That's why the last beekeeper, where the idea came from, is I've also kept bees. And a couple years ago, I lost 40,000 bees in one day. And what happened, it was the hive was doing great. And I was really proud of it. I'd built the hive, the wooden box hive that you see. I'd built it with my own hands, with hammers and nails, and I was very proud of it. And the bees were doing great. They were thriving. They were filling out the frame with honey, and the brood, the cells of the, you know, the baby bees are growing, they were doing great. And then one day in August, all 40,000 died. And it wasn't from colony collapse disorder, which is this sort of mysterious syndrome where bees fly away and don't return. So my bees came home. They just died in a pile. And it couldn't have been like viral or bacterial or, you know, a fungal infection, because that would have happened slowly. So I took a breath. I'm like, okay, I'm going to try this again. So the next year I restocked my hive. And again in August, almost to the week, they all died again. And I came to realize that it was chemicals that people were using on their lawns in my very pretty suburban neighborhood. And I don't know who, I don't think that anybody did it on purpose, but these chemicals are legal. And so that's what inspired The Last Beekeeper, which is, for people who aren't familiar with the story, it's set in the very near future. Like, it feels like a future that looks like today. It's not in the distant future with different technology or anything. It's could be next month. And what I set in place, something that speeds up the collapse of our pollinators, and we start losing them faster than we're expecting. Because even right now, we know we're losing them. You know, you see the Save the Bees hashtag everywhere. But in my book, I create a situation that speeds up the demise of our pollinators, and we're not ready. So it sends the world into this agricultural and food security crisis, which becomes an economic and political crisis. So that's the backdrop. And it was all inspired by those years that I lost my bees. Because the second year, the same week, I lost the bees. So I was really thinking, what about the local pollinators? What about the native wild species? Are they dying too? And it just got in my head, and I kept churning this over and over in my mind. What if they all died? And that's where the story came from. And in The Last Beekeeper, I put it in the far enough in the future that it's believable that it could happen, and close enough to us right now that it's scary, that it's it feels like it's a situation that could actually happen.
I'm not sure, at least I didn't really think about the absolutely essential role of pollinators in agriculture. You know, I mean, the thing is that for most of us, you know, farming and raising food has become so distanced. I mean, we're just used to going down to the store, you know, and buying it. I mean, I really regret the loss of seasonal thing. I was talking to someone from the Midwest the other night, an author. And, you know, when I was young, I could remember before the suburbs got to be so thick that I could go from Winnetka right down Hibbard Road, and there was corn in the fields and, you know, wonderful Midwest ripe tomatoes. I mean, I haven't seen a decent tomato since I was in Turkey some years ago. And, you know, you felt closer, but now you can buy food, seasonal food, all year round at Costco. I mean, you can go and get candy, you can do whatever. And I think, you know, the rhythm of life when, you know, it used to be like fall was apples and, you know, and pumpkins and, you know, spring was whatever it was, you know, May was asparagus and the whole bit. We've lost that, you know, and it isn't even feel like a treat anymore. Yeah. It used to be exciting, you know, when the strawberries would come in or you could harvest the asparagus, and it made you feel the whole change of seasons. But now it isn't really working that way.
Yeah, and I do touch on that in The Last Beekeeper, in that the book is told in two timelines. My main character, her name is Sasha. She's the daughter of a man who is infamously known as The Last Beekeeper. And in one timeline, she's 11, and it's right before the collapse of the pollinators. In my book, I call it the Great Collapse. So when she's 11, she's living on this farm with her father, and it's very idyllic. It's beautiful. She's kind of a half feral child, runs around playing in the woods. She helps her father tend bees, and she loves her father. And it's a really wonderful time. And then the bees die off much more quickly than we expect. Her father's implicated in some potentially nefarious dealings involving bees. And then in the second timeline, Sasha's 22, and her father has been in prison for 10 years. And so she's kind of been adrift in the world. And she finally returns home to that farm, and it's been abandoned for years. And when she gets there, she feels that loss of, like what you're saying, the connection to the land that I think we all feel a little bit of these days. And so, you know, it's a kind of a dystopian world. It feels a little bit like if you took the Great Depression and put it in the future. There's a lot of, you know, there's not enough food. There's a lot of hunger, you know, poverty, unemployment. So it has a little bit of a Great Depression vibe, even though it's in the future.
It's the Dust Bowl, I think, more than the Depression.
Yes,
Bowl.
Yes, exactly.
When the world around all those people, you know, and that came actually from an agricultural mistake.
A clearing all the land. Yeah, so it's like we have a hand in all this. And so when she comes home and goes back to her family's farm that's been abandoned, she, you know, doesn't have much access to food. She has to literally go foraging in the forest and on the abandoned fields around her family's home. And she becomes very in tuned with the food that once grew there, that could grow there, and is spends a lot of time trying to like revive a patch of land to bring it back to life so that she can grow food there again, which to me felt very, a redemptive act of trying to save just this one patch of land and trying to grow the right food at the right time in the right place. Because you're right, we don't think about that anymore. And I think that reconnection to the land for Sasha was a really important character arc, because she'd been separated from the land, you know, for 10 years after her father went to prison, and to come back and get her hands back in the dirt was really important. And I'll tell you a funny story about it. Is the second timeline, initially Sasha lived in a city, and it was longing to be back at the farm and reminiscing in her mind about, you know, all the good times she had with her family back on the farm, but she wasn't on the farm. And at one point my editor had to pull me aside and say, "Julie, what are you doing? Get her out of the city. The city is not your comfort zone of where to write. You need to get your characters where they can touch dirt, be in the forest and be in nature, or they're not going to be happy." And I was like, oh, okay. I thought I was making them complicated and interesting by making her longing so much to be back home. But really, I went into her city apartment, I packed all of her bags up, and I moved her back out to the farm, and the whole story opened up when I did that. Because my editor was right. Not only does Sasha need to have her hands in the dirt, but I need to have my hands in the dirt. So I learned a good lesson about that. So apparently I don't write city scenes very well, but maybe one day.
Well, I think, you know, part of it depends on the story you want to tell. And part of what you want to tell is the stubbornness of actual life. There was a wonderful mystery. I can't remember the name of it at this point. It doesn't really matter because it's not available. But I think he was a Greenland. Pretty sure he was Icelandic or in Greenland. Anyway, a country that had a seed bank. And it was the first time I really thought about, because, you know, they could keep it frozen. And it was the first time I really thought about, you know, how important that would be to try to collect, you know, seeds for all of the plants and so forth that, you know, we're used to, whether they're flowers or whether they're grains or, you know, whatever, in case there is some kind of apocalypse, you know, to have a supply of all of this to try to, you know, repopulate everything. So, I mean, I think there's always that sense of, you know, can we repopulate it? You know, if war devastates, can a population spring back? I mean, look at the Ukraine, for example. What is it they're facing in the, you know, however this war winds down, their land has been devastated.
Yeah.
Or look at Chernobyl, you know, where all kinds of strange things have happened, you know, in a clearly toxic environment. There have been several books written recently about, you know, there's still life in Chernobyl, but it's different, you know, because of the nuclear fallout and the pollution and so forth. So, you know, your story is designed to, you know, give us some kind of hope that in spite of this terrible thing that has happened with the pollinators, that there may be
hope,
you know, to bring them back. Do you think that the, you know, obviously it interests you, but do you think that the eco thriller got a big push from D.E. Owens, you know, Where the Crawdads Sing, that people, because it was so popular, it did make people more aware of, you know, that lifestyle?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways it did, because her character, I think, what was her, Kaya, I think was the main character in that book. She was also this like half feral child that lived out in the wilderness, out in a marsh, and she was so connected to the land. And I think that, you know, Delia Owens did that so beautifully. That was my favorite part of the book, is when Kaya was a child living in the marsh and just existing and coexisting, which I don't think we coexist very well. Humans don't. We like to exist and dominate a landscape, not coexist with it. And I think that Kaya in Where the Crawdads Sing just coexisted. And so that when that book came out, I had already written my first book, Waiting for the Night Song, and I had, you know, we'd been shopping it around to editors, and the editor who ended up purchasing it contacted my agent and said, I really like this book. I'm going to try to, you know, take it up the ladder to the publisher and get an okay on this. But she didn't like the comp titles that I was, the other titles I was offering. It's like, if you liked this book, you would like my book. She didn't agree with the titles I was giving her. And so she gave us 24 hours because her publisher was getting on a plane and wanted to take the book with me. So she's like, you need to have 24 hours before they get on the plane, and I want better comp titles. So I was like frantic. I had just gotten home on a red eye flight from across the country. And I went to my local bookseller and I was like, here's what the book is about. Here's all the things that you need to know about the book. Please help me find a comp title. And she's like, well, this book just came out. I just read it. It sounds really interesting. And she, you know, for you. And she picks it up and it was Where the Crawdads Sing. And that was the book, the comp title we used to sell Waiting for the Night Song. So I do think it has a lot of weight, and it conjures up this element of like coexisting with nature in kind of in a symbiotic relationship, not in a humans dominating it kind of way.
Whenever there's a enormous success like that, it does bring readers to awareness. I mean, you know, people have asked me over the years, you know, how do you know what the next big thing is? I actually fought with the publisher to get Delia to the store. It was such an unlikely book, you know, to be a bestseller. And I think it was Delia and me and one other person, although, you know, she signed a whole lot. I mean, I wish I'd ordered thousands. I ordered a couple hundred, you know, looking back. If I were really a genius, I would have had thousands. It was not a book that you would have expected at first glance, you know, to have that kind of effect. But, you know, looking back, I remind people that after Silence of the Lambs, there was a whole slug of serial killer books. After Da Vinci Code, we got what I call Da Vinci clones. We got religious conspiracy thrillers all over.
Yeah,
you know, and I think I don't know exactly what it is. Whether it's reader awareness, whether people are trying to repeat the experience, whether, you know, why is it that people? I wish I could answer that. Why is it people flock to? Right now we are deluged with women's stories about World War II. I've reached the point where I just can't read another, you know, about a brave librarian or a brave book. I mean, and they're wonderful books and the stories are great, and that's not the issue. There's just too many of them. But I realized as I was sitting writing my April newsletter that all of a sudden in April and May I've got four books about female serial killers and female rage. And I'm gonna tie it back to the whole Harvey Weinstein Me Too thing.
Yeah.
Where, you know, because serial killers were men, you know, they were always men. And now here we are with triplet sisters or, you know, whatever it is, females.
Have you read The Change?
No.
By I think you would love it. It came out, I think, in September or August, and I believe it was one of the book club picks, like Good Morning America or something. But it's about the three women of a certain age who are, you know, going through the change, they feel like they're invisible, and all their rage, like their menopausal rage, starts manifesting in superpowers. And it's not a silly story, though. It's like, when I say the superpowers, like, one of them literally can manifest balls of fire when she gets a hot flash. It's channeling this female rage of becoming invisible. And it's a wonderful book. It was, I think, Kristen Miller, I think, is the author. It's called The Change. And it's a wonderful story of these three women who just refuse to become invisible. And I love this book. I recommend it to everybody.
Oh, good. I will pay attention to it. If it wasn't a crime novel, I probably let it kind of fly.
It's a crime novel because the three of them team up to try to solve this, these missing girls going missing in their community, but the throwaway isn't the right term, but they're like runaways or prostitutes, and nobody's paying attention to these girls either. So these women who think society thinks are invisible take on the role of becoming the protectors of these girls who people think are invisible, and they try to hunt down who the killer is. And it's great. I think you would love it. From what I know of your reading taste, I think you'd love this book.
Well, thank you. It's always wonderful to have a recommendation, and I was just writing a little piece about the fact that, you know, we're seeing female rage and female serial killers. So this may be the next trend. We may be moving away from heroic women performing extraordinary wartime duties to
female rage.
And, you know, I think it's not just the Me Too thing. I also think, you know, part of this is aging, that, you know, as we get older, there is this feeling, I think, oftentimes with men and women, that we become more, you know, we become invisible, that people, you know, kind of buy, which has given rise to yet another sort of slowly growing subcategory, which is the senior sleuth.
Yeah, so, yes, you know, I've seen a lot of that.
Killers of a certain age.
Oh, yes, yes, wonderful. I just got that. I haven't read it yet, but I just got it.
Yeah, it used to be that we only had Dorothy Gilman's Mrs. Polifax, but now, you know, we have Deanna, and Spencer Quinn is coming out with a book from your publisher in Point of Fact in July. I think it's called Mrs. Plansky. Mrs. Plansky's.
Oh, I don't know about that one.
Well, it is, I said, your publisher, Alexa, if you're watching.
Yeah. I'll have to get a copy of that. Yeah, right. Alexa, I'd like a copy.
There have been a couple with men too, but I think, you know, it's in a way, it's giving power back to, or not giving back to, it's giving power to people who have felt themselves powerless, that they, you know, they can't obviously do, you know, super sleuthing. I mean, they don't have the stamina or the physical, you know, capability of doing the hard takedown or whatever. So they tend to use, you know, they're wily and they're curious.
I love that. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and because they're kind of invisible, they can snoop in a way that, you know, is underestimated. It's kind of below the radar. So I love watching this kind of virgin.
Can I tell you just a teeny teaser about the new book I'm working on? Because I think it fits into this conversation. So we don't have a publishing date. I signed a contract for two more books with Tor Forge. The third book is going to be due in November. So I don't know what that means timing wise, but I'm thinking either late 2024 or early 25 probably. But it's also an ego thriller again, and it has to do with three women who live on or adjacent to a new subdivision that was built on a piece of deforested land. The idea of the deforestation came from this piece of land that I was protecting from when I bought my farm. But one of the women is a young girl just about to enter puberty. One is a woman in her 30s, and one is a menopausal woman who's got some rage going on. And the three of them are being very affected by the loss of this land in very different ways. And the forest has this kind of feminine vibe to the land. And so the forest, which is gone, it's been clear cut to build this community. The three women are drawn to this land in a way that they feel the grief of the land when the forest was gone, and that they kind of internalize this grief and come to believe that the forest is the haunting them. Whether it's real or whether it's psychological, you'll have to wait till 2024 or 2025 to find out. But it's about this piece of land and these three women at three very different pivotal moments in your, you know, a female life of, you know, being an 11-year-old, being in your 30s, trying to get pregnant, and in your mid-50s, and how that, I don't know, some of this feminine connection to the land, which I'm really loving writing. I've been writing it here. I don't know if your viewers can see out my window, but I'm in the Dominican Republic right now. And I've been writing while I'm here, and I'm just like, I'm super excited about this book. And I definitely, it's not the biggest theme in the book, but the invisible mid-50s woman with a little bit of rage going on is definitely going to show up in this book.
I love it. So the minute you hear clear-cut, it just is depressing. I mean, I hate the very thought of clear-cut. And yet I can say, Julie, that having, you know, traveled enormously around, well, everywhere really, but also about this part of the country, when you see the horrible damage that the bark beetle has done, it makes me even, in many ways, makes me sadder than clear cutting. And, you know, back in the South, when I lived in the Southeast, the lack of chestnut trees, the fact that, you know, the chestnut blight had been. And when I grew up in the Midwest, was it the elm? I think it's the elm tree. You know, there came a pest from someplace, the Dutch elm disease prevailed. And really, and, you know, landscapes can change the whole vibe of the landscape and all. Trees are so crucial to it. I think what's going on in the Amazon at the moment, you know, they keep clear cutting it to do more forestry, or I mean, to more, you know, agriculture or whatever it is they're doing. But I spend a lot of money every year contributing to replanting trees, you know, to replanting the chestnuts or whatever it is, because I do think that's a big part of what we're all looking at, you know, as the planet is changing. And yet, let's be realistic. There's a reason there's coal in Siberia, you know, and that at one point it wasn't frozen, or we wouldn't have coal, right?
So, yeah, and I think also, you know, like when you talk about all these different changes in different, you know, ecosystems, that in the end, the earth is going to be fine. Everything we're doing to the earth is horrible, you know, with the fossil fuels and not treating our planet very well, but in the end, the earth is going to be fine. It's going to recover. It's just, will we, you know, when we talk about saving the planet, we're not saving the planet. We don't have the capacity to save this planet. What we're doing is trying to save ourselves. And even saving the bees, like people's, like in my book, saving the bees, it's saving us. We're trying to save ourselves, because when we're gone from this planet, it's going to heal, you know, from all Chernobyl, from all the different things we've done to this planet. Eventually, it's going to come back to equilibrium and the planet's going to be just fine. We just won't be here. So I feel like when we say save the planet, save the earth, save, what we're really saying underneath it is, how can we save ourselves? Because Earth's going to be fine without us.
Basically, it'll shrug us off, just like shrugged off the dinosaurs or whatever it may be. I'm sure there have been, you know, successive cataclysms of one sort or another. And also, you know, at some point the sun will die and, you know, there we go. So there are a lot of people, you know, deeply interested in space travel and colonizing other planets, again, with the idea of saving ourselves, you know. Becomes inhabitable if our solar system goes down, you know, where will we be?
And I say all that, but I also feel really strongly about that. I have a lot of hope. Like, I write about dark topics, but I write about them through a lens of hope. Like, I think all the characters in my books, or at least the main characters, have a relentless capacity for hope, not a Pollyanna hope, not an unrealistic kind of hope, but I think that it's because I believe in that. I think I give that to my characters because it's the only thing I can believe in. But I think that as much, you know, disasters we're facing in the future, there's so much that's worth fighting for, so much worth, you know, like if we just sit around being grief-stricken about what we're losing, we don't see the things that are still there to fight for. And I think all of my books, I feel very strongly like that's kind of an underlying theme, whether I think about it consciously or not. It's about this, there's a lot of really bad stuff going on and we're responsible for so much of it and we can do so much better. But instead of just getting paralyzed by the grief or the fear, We also need to be like I'm looking at, you know, this window behind me. There is a lot of beauty left in this world and so much worth fighting for. And so I think my characters embody that a lot, that they are in the midst of disasters, but they have hope and they have, you know, a reason to fight to make things better. And I don't think I'll ever write a book that doesn't have that element in it. I don't know if I can, like the new book, we know the one about the deforestation. I feel like there's also a really hopeful story for the characters. And I just think that it's too easy to just go dark and stay there. Like if you don't fight for that little sliver of hope shining through, like what do we have to fight for? So I will, you know, as dark as my books can get, there's always going to be a little light shining in with some hope.
Well, you believe in regeneration.
Yes, so, exactly.
You know, that's really where it comes from. Well, you know, what we haven't talked about are the squatters. Because, you know, a complication of the return to the farm that Sasha goes through is that she discovers there are squatters. And you know, there's a phrase currently going around called found family. Mm-hmm. And I think that applies here, you know, that, you know, while she's initially unhappy, maybe scared, maybe outraged, whatever it is about the squatters. After a while, you know, they do become a found family.
Yeah, that group.
That means that, you know, they're not tied by blood. They're, you know, people who come together who are unrelated genetically, who, yeah. You know, decide to create the sort of bond that that a family that is genetically together would have.
Yeah, and that group of characters, the squatters, are, I think, my favorite characters I've ever written in any like book or short story or anything. I love the group of them together. And so when Sasha returns to the farm that she grew up in, she goes back there with a purpose to try. She's trying to find some research that she believes her father hid somewhere on the farm. And so she has a goal and a mission when she returns when she's 22 to find this research. And when she gets there, the squatters have taken over the farm. And again, if you remember, it's kind of like you said, you know, kind of Dust Bowl era vibe, even though it's in the future. There's kind of a little bit of anarchy, food insecurity. So it's a little scary to approach squatters because they've taken over this property and she's not, can't fight them. So when she goes there, it's with her defenses up against these people. But pretty soon she warms up to them, they warm up to her. And when they do start to form a friendship, which, you know, evolves into a family, she gets to a point where she starts thinking, you know, maybe I don't need to be digging into my past anymore. Maybe I need to let the past go, let all this stuff with my father go, my history, not find his research, and just look forward into the future with this new family that I'm creating. And just when she gets comfortable with that idea of like, okay, I'm going to let it all go, I'm going to forget the past, she sees, or she thinks she sees, a honeybee. And that's something that like turns, like whether she's imagining it, is it a manifestation of her own guilt or grief? Is it a longing for her past, or is it a real bee? And then she has to wrestle with this huge question. And is it going to implode this family that she's created? So I give her everything she wanted. She gets a chance to find her father's research. She gets the chance to have a family, but they both can't coexist at the same time without possibly imploding all of it. So I put her kind of in a tight spot. But that family, they're all young people. They're all in their 20s and they're all really different. They have very different backgrounds. They're all a little bit broken. And I really liked the idea of taking these very different characters and isolating them on this farm in the middle of nowhere where they don't have their communities. They're like Sasha, they're all disconnected from their people. And they find each other and are able to build something new. And I just really love that idea of in all the brokenness, we can still build something new. And that's what I love about that little group of characters.
So one of the phrases that was used to describe this book is called superior world building. And if you are writing, in fact, something something in the future, you do have to do world building because it isn't exactly the world that we live in. You know, it's very important in science fiction and fantasy that you are a great world builder. But do you enjoy that part? Is that another reason that you like, you know, this sort of book is that you get to do world building?
Yeah, I loved that part. In fact, I had done a lot more world building that actually showed up in the book. I had to dial it back because I got really granular. I created an entire new currency system, and I went really far. All these different social classes of people related to the jobs they had in the new agricultural deal that I created. And it was just too granular. My editor was like, okay, all right, this is just too much detail about the economy and the financial structures. But I needed to know it. But I really felt like I inhabited this world. And I liked how it was both, you know, like the future and the past at the same time. I liked how it was, you know, where they lived in the farm, they were off the grid. So they didn't have electricity and running water. They had to fend for themselves. They had to grow food based on, you know, the resources they had. And so it was kind of going backwards and forwards at the same time. And that was difficult because we had, you know, they had the internet and modern technology exists, but it didn't exist for them. And so they were both living with it and without it at the same time. And that was kind of the line I was walking of creating new elements in this world while always looking back at our world, because the readers who are reading it are contemporary readers. And I want them to see themselves in the book because I want them to feel like this could happen any minute. And like, what would I do? And how would I exist in this world where we've lost, you know, doesn't seem to be much, there's a lot of lawlessness. There's, you know, the food systems aren't intact. All the inequalities we already have are exacerbated. You know, the people who are food insecure now, in the future that I've created, it's worse. So I don't know. I spent a lot of time in my own head building that world. And I feel really proud of it because I feel like I hit a note that it feels believable and rich enough, but I didn't go too far into all the economics.
Well, you know, you're writing a thriller. In a thriller, if you were writing epic fantasy, you know, which is like two or three times the length of your book, then you actually have the space to be that granular. And that's one reason I think people like epic fantasy. They want, you know, you to create a geography. They want you to create currency. You have to create belief systems, you know, social norms, all kinds of interesting stuff. But in a thriller, you know, if you wait around too much, you lose the pulse of the action. And so, you know, world building in a thriller is relatively rare, it seems to me.
I really enjoyed it. And I also took a lot of inspiration, ironically, from like the Little House on the Prairie books about the way that they farmed. Because I really loved those books when I was a little girl. And I, you know, used to kind of, you know, in my, you know, imagine, fantasize about being a little girl on the prairie and how they made do with so little and had to be creative and had to find their own fixes for things. So I feel like I was drawing from the past, the not so distant past in our country, but also merging it into the future, which was a fun challenge.
You bet. Did you read The Martian by Andy Weir?
Yeah. Yes, I did.
I mean, I think that's another great example of it. You know, I mean, he's got to fight off starvation while he's, you know, waiting to see what will happen, whether somebody will rescue him or not. But I thought that Andy did a really interesting job.
You know? Yeah, I love that whole world, the whole agricultural system he set up, and you know how he, you know, made use of the resources he had. I love that kind of story.
Yeah, no, I think it's fascinating. Well, a question that we often get is, you know, what kind of books do you like to read? So I'll preempt Ian and ask you that question. We've talked about stuff that we both like, but, you know, anything else you'd like to throw into the mix?
Well, I'll tell you, I actually have it right here because it's the book I brought with me on vacation. Have you read this book, The Light Pirate?
I've heard of it.
By Lily Brooks Dalton, not related to me. She's a Dalton, but we are not related. I love this book. I think the world building in this book's amazing. It's also a near future climate. I don't know if you'd call it a thriller necessarily, but it has that kind of a character, kind of like Delia Owens' character Kaya in Waiting Where the Crawdads Sing, that she's a girl that's so in nature, but has some magical realism elements in it. It kind of pushes us into the future where Florida is completely altered by hurricanes and rising water. So it's almost uninhabited, that the only people who live there are living, you know, in towns that are, or like cities that have been like half eaten up by the ocean, right, or they're living in tree houses because the water has come in. It's a beautifully written story about human resilience, and about the love of the land and hope. That's what I always go back to. I think that's why I'm drawn to it, but I think it's a gorgeous novel.
Well, I think Florida is actually at some risk of that happening. In fact, yeah, there was trying to remember whether it was the Times or the Post. Well, anyway, did a big feature on the Outer Banks Islands and how, you know, the ocean is basically eroding them. I think what's at risk there are basically vacation houses more than anything else. But, you know, the road has been eaten up and the houses now either have to be moved back to whatever land is available. So it's not like a, you know, a food crisis or whatever it is. But it's clear that the rising oceans. And I remember when my husband and I were in Holland last time, which might have been 2018, something like that. Anyway, before the pandemic, they took us to see the North Sea water technology that Holland has developed. And, you know, in that made it clear that whatever the plane of the earth is, as the Greenland ice cap is melting, Greenland is rising, which means that Holland is sinking.
Sinking, yeah.
And so their water management, their, you know, sea management and all, is becoming every day more crucial to them. Because, you know, that we know that the Greenland ice cap is melting. I mean, I first went to Greenland, I can't remember, maybe 15 or so years ago. And you got to see one little place at the bottom of Greenland. Now you can take tours. You know, you can sail around and you can land mid-Greenland. We did the Northwest Passage cruise and there wasn't even any ice. They had an icebreaker to help the ship and the whole thing. And there wasn't any ice. No ice. So there weren't any bears. You know, polar bears, the whole thing. So anyone who believes that, you know, the climate isn't warming and that these things are going to happen is just willfully blinding themselves. So the question is, to what degree can we use ingenuity, technology, take advantage of what there is and, you know, and try to cope with all this? And I think the Dutch are really brilliant because they've had to learn all along.
They've been fighting the water forever.
They have, and now it's becoming more acute, but they also have better technology to fight it with. So it'll be kind of interesting to see. But if you go to Holland, it's really worth going up to. I'm trying to remember what it's called, but anyway, there's a whole sort of North Sea barrier thing that they have done, which, you know, may give other people an opportunity. I mean, who knows what they're going to do in Miami or New York City. New York City is equally in danger. Yeah. If, you know, we had that flood a little while back and things you wouldn't even think about, like wine cellars were, you know,
the subway
you would think about, but you know, you don't realize, you know, in these giant skyscrapers and so forth, how much underground machinery and so forth is required, you know, to make them function.
You know what we have going on in Boston, where I'm from, Boston was used to be like two hills, and one of the hills was kind of flattened and filled in a flatter area so that we could have more land. And so the water, it's very wet underground. We filled the land and then built a Boston proper, like Boston's Back Bay, and you know, the iconic area where the Common is. But what they did is they took these pylons, these wooden, like pine, you know, beams, and they put them into the ground. And so they could, because the ground was so soft and wet, so they could find harder ground underneath. And then they built the homes on slabs on top of these pylons. So water has remained under there forever. And it actually preserved the pine. This, I guess it's seawater, I guess. But it's preserving the pine. It's like, but our water's changing and it's actually drying out in this part, and those beams that have been underwater for centuries are being exposed to air and they're rotting. So these iconic buildings in Boston are cracking, their foundations are cracking, wall, you can see it in some places, and they're having to go to extraordinary measures to shore up so many buildings in Boston because of this.
Well, that's what happens when they bring up shipwrecks, you know, the Mary Rose. There's a marvelous one in the harbor in Stockholm that has its own museum, which the name of which temporarily escapes me, but it was a Swedish ship that went down, and they, you know, they have to keep it in salt water or otherwise it happens. But, you know, that's what's going on in Venice. I'm from Chicago, and people don't realize that Chicago was basically built on mud.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was Chicago, and Indian means something like place of the pigs. And a tremendous amount of slippery land, water, whatever it is. And so I think those same kind of problems will start to change. And, you know, if there's a change between salt water and fresh water, it will make a big difference. So, you know, it's going on all around us, but I think that, you know, the planet has always evolved. It's gone from hot to cold and, you know, little ice age to heat in the whole vent. And as you say, the question is, what's the human tolerance for our changing conditions? And, you know, we are mammals that may not be able to adapt to very high temperature. And, you know, what will that do? But, you know, the pace of it is accelerated, which makes it scarier, because those kinds of changes used to take place over millennia. Now they're taking place in centuries and, you know, may even begin to be measured in decades. So
I think a lot of the stuff that that you're talking about are things that I ruminate on a lot. I think about them, and I think that's why I write about them, in part because I think it's my own, like my own version of performing therapy on myself, is writing, you know, writing through
writing what you fear, right?
Yeah, writing about what I fear. I think like all of the two books I've already published and the two new books that I have under contract are all manifestations of my climate anxieties, but writing through them with hope. And I think that it makes me, it's not like I'm trying to say everything's going to be okay. And I never provide answers in the book. Like never be like, and now it's going to be fine because we have this new technology. I do not do that, but I do provide a reason to believe that there could be hope. And I think that it helps me, you know, just psychologically work through these things to kind of think through them. So Jeff Vandermeer, he wrote Annihilation and, was it Hummingbird Salamander? Is that what it's called? Yeah. So he was interviewed in The Atlantic a couple years ago, and I'm going to get the quote wrong, but the essence of what he said was that novels are laboratories for the future, and that novelists, like, we can go into the future in these, in our books are laboratories for how the world might be, and they might be a world we don't want to happen. And the effect will be people will read it and try to avoid that future. Or it can be an aspirational laboratory where we create a world that we hope will happen and try to inspire readers to make it happen. And I love that idea that every book is a laboratory for a world that could exist, and that we get to create that world and then share it with people. And for me, that's like a, such a, like an honor to like be able to create a world that other people might come visit and maybe get something out of it is, I love that. I think I have the best job in the world.
Well, that's a magnificent thought. And I think we should end on that and summon Ian up to see if there are any questions from viewers. At this hour of the day, probably not so many, Julie. It generally works out that people watch these in their own time and very often in the evening. So Ian, are you there? Hello.
Yes.
Ah, there he is. Okay.
We do have a question here. Have your books inspired any changes in laws or in the actions of people?
I'm not aware of any laws, but I do. I get a lot of people asking me about, I mean, what we were talking about earlier about the bees, about what we can do to protect bees. And I think that it's a policy level decisions are the ones that matter the most. So being involved in local decisions, even in your municipality, your city, your neighborhoods, like, you know, what you were saying, Barbara, about the, what kind of plants are allowed in your community, you're protecting the environment by being responsible for what you plant and helping to, you know, educate other people. And, you know, like my pollinator garden, I don't have any delusion that my pollinator garden is going to change the world, but it is protecting pollinators in my community. And if a lot more people did that, it helps, you know, just all those little things help, but the real things need to be on policy level. Like when I talked about my bees dying from a chemical poisoning, it's because the United States allows these chemicals to be used. Other countries don't. In Europe, that stuff is outlawed. We're not allowed to. They're not allowed to use them there. So if we could just have enough action, and so it's, you know, I think that there's small things we can do in our personal lives, but it's going to take bigger action. And I wish I could say my books have inspired that, but I do know I've had readers write to me telling me that they weren't that motivated about climate change before, but they read Waiting for the Night Song, and they cared about the characters. And because they cared about the characters, by the end of the book, they cared about what happened to them, which meant they cared about climate change. And so if, you know, even if a few readers are experiencing that change and doing small things, it's all I can hope for, you know, for the impact my books can have. If it's bigger than that, that would be great. But that's all I know of.
Saving the world one person at a time. That's sort of how it works. Anything else, Ian?
How do you select the names of your characters?
It's funny that I let my daughter name Sasha. And I have three girls, I have three daughters and a son. My oldest daughter named Sasha because I wanted a character who had a nickname that came from a traditional name that you might not recognize. Her name's Alexandra, but she goes by Sasha because in her adult life, she doesn't want people to know she's the daughter of the last beekeeper. So I wanted a nickname that she didn't need to legally change. And so my daughter came up with Sasha. The character Octavia in that book is a nod to one of my favorite writers in the world, which is Octavia Butler. She's a bookseller in Last Beekeeper. And many of the other characters, they just sort of came to me. They weren't names that have any particular meaning. They just like that was Hallie's name was just Hallie. So sometimes they're functional. There's a character, I'm not going to do any spoilers, but she goes by two different names in the book and she almost plays two different characters, but it's the same person. You don't really quite recognize it. So I need her name to do some extra lifting. And if you have time to indulge one quick story, in Waiting for the Night Song, there's a character named Garrett, who is a main character in the book. And I named him, or I created this character after a boy I used to see sitting on the end of a pier. Year after year after year, I would go kayaking by his pier, and this little boy was always sitting there alone growing up. And I wrote him as a character in Waiting for the Night Song. And I named him Garrett after Garrett County, Maryland, which is where my grandmother's from. And she's who I dedicated my book to. So I named him Garrett after my grandmother. And when the book was published, I went to that boy's pier. He's an adult now. And I brought a copy of the book and I just said, you know, hopefully you don't think this is creepy, but I saw you on this pier for years and it inspired an idea and I wrote a book and I just wanted to give it to you. Now he wasn't there, his mother was. And she said to me, Garrett's going to be so sorry he missed you. His name was Garrett. Wow. So sometimes these things come to us from places we can't explain. So I just, when the character names himself, I just go with it.
And finally, what do you find more challenging, beginning the writing of a book or deciding when to end the book?
That's a good question. With the two books that I've completed, there are two different answers. Waiting for the Night Song, I didn't know how it was going to end. I wrote the ending of that book 8 different times. I mean, I don't mean just tweaking it. Like it had 8 different endings. Wow. But The Last Beekeeper, I always knew exactly how this book was going to end. And I wrote the book towards that ending. Like everything I was writing to get to this scene that was going to satisfy all the arcs and all the characters. And I find that a much more satisfying way to write. And that's what I'm also doing in my third book. So I feel like if you can get an idea of an ending or just a general idea of an ending, for me, it makes the writing easier. I have a harder time starting a book of knowing where to start and when to start. But I think it's probably different for everybody.
Great. Thank you.
Sometimes as an editor, I can say that finding the right start is a very difficult thing. We published a book years ago that won the Seamus Award for Best First Private Eye Novel. And when I read it, I went back to the author and I said, this book actually starts on the third page of chapter 3. And he was like, no, you know, I don't want to change it. I said, no, really. I said, this is where the book starts. And so sometimes you have to write a lot in order to get to the place where the book starts, but then you have to realize that you have to get rid of the stuff that got you to that place or move it. You know, you don't necessarily have to throw it away. Sometimes you just have to move it later into the story. But, you know, a great start is just as important as a satisfying ending.
Yeah. And I feel like the ending and the beginning and the ending of a book in some ways need to be in conversation with each other, even if the reader doesn't realize it as they're reading. I feel like when you finish a good book, the ending should reflect back on the beginning in some way.
Yes, you're right. It needs to reflect back, but it also needs to be as good as the beginning. And many books sink because the ending doesn't live up to the promise of, you know, of the
book. They always say that the opening of a book sells that book, but the ending of it sells your next book. Like if people don't like the ending of your book, they're not going to buy your next one. So you got to hook them on those first pages to buy the first book. But if your ending stinks, they're not going to buy the second one.
Well, that certainly seems like the place we ought to end this conversation. Very nice. Thank you for feeding us that line. So let me remind you again, we've been talking about The Last Beekeeper. We have autographed copies either in the store or momentarily arriving at the store, which I urge you to buy. And thank you very much for spending time with us, Julie. Always a pleasure. I'll look forward to your third book.
So thank you,
everybody. Thank you. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.